السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيبي إله العالمين أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. قال الله في كتابه الحكيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، واسألهم عن القرية التي كانت حاضرة البحر إذ يعدون في السبت إذ تأتيهم حيتانهم يوم سبتهم شرعا ويوم لا يسبتون لا تأتيهم كذلك نبلوهم بما كانوا يفسقون. صدق الله العلي العظيم، وصلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Throughout the verses of the Quran, we're informed that the group known as Banu Israel had choices. And they were given flexibility in their choices. And that their fate was determined by the behaviors, their choices. And so we're told that specifically when it came to the rituals of the faith. There's a verse or a hadith in which the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he's asked a question or a number of questions by some of the companions, and the Prophet provides an answer, and some of the companions ask the Prophet to further elaborate. So give us more. And the Prophet had informed them in his answer of a certain obligation, something which was either wajib or obligatory or haram. And so the Prophet stays silent when they persist, when they continue to ask questions. And so they asked again, and the Prophet stayed silent, and they asked again, the Prophet stayed silent, until finally he said, listen, take what I have given you, and don't ask about anything else. Because if I am to give you an answer, then that would create an obligation for you. And he said, do not be like the people of Musa, that they would continuously ask questions more than what their prophets had given them, and because they would ask for more, then they had to do more. And that's why their faith was loaded with rituals, what they had to observe or what they had to refrain from. So we're told that the Banu Israel, in a number of occasions, especially during the time of Musa, specifically during the time of Musa, that because of their choices and because of their persistence, it had created a certain situation where they had chosen their fate. And on a number of occasions, God tells them, live with that fate that you have chosen for yourself. When it came to, for instance, their worship, everything that they saw, their attitude was that the grass was greener on the other side, that there was always something that was better, that God had not given them that which was best. God didn't give them that which was enough. So, for instance, we're told that when it came to when they crossed the ocean with Musa, when they fled from Fir'aun, and you know, here you have a group of people that had experienced a miracle. I mean, nobody before them had experienced that sort of miracle, where an ocean was just split for them, and they could walk through casually, and after they were done walking through, the ocean came crashing down again, the walls of the ocean came crashing down again, and it obliterated their enemy. And so the signs of belief were there. The miracles were there. But then what does the Quran tell us? That as soon as they got to the other side, they came across people who were worshipping a shiny object. They were worshipping an idol. And it was very attractive. So they turned to Musa, they said, listen, Musa, we appreciate everything you've done, the miracles, all that, but look at what these guys have. And we want something exactly like this. How come you can't produce something like this for us to worship? So for them, whatever they had, whatever what was in their life as a blessing, their attitude was that the grass was always greener on the other side. That there was always something better. They were never satisfied enough. When it came to their food, when it came to their sustenance, likewise, they had the same attitude. God tells them that we've given you al-manna wa-salwa, we've given you the best type of food, we've given you quail meat, which even today is very rare. I mean, you could compare it to, I don't know, something very rare. What's rare out there? A tomahawk steak or something. And it was the best quality of what they had. But then they wanted to be vegans. They said, give us lentils and give us onions and give us the stuff that grows from the ground. So to them, what they had in terms of sustenance was not good enough for them. They wanted something else. And Musa said that why would you trade something which is of a higher quality for something which is of a lower quality? Again, that goes back to the attitude that whatever I have is not good enough. And sometimes, you know, we don't realize that what we have and what God has given us at this moment in our life is good enough for you. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be complacent and we should settle and we should never be ambitious. See, it's an art and not a science to balance content with ambition. Some people, they're too content with their lives. And that they won't lift a finger. They won't do anything, no matter what. They're too much to this side. They're too content. And some people are super ambitious. They're very, very ambitious in that they overlook the blessings that God has given them. So there's no way to, and that's what I mean by there's no science behind understanding the balance between being content and being ambitious. It's really an art and not a science. But having content, we know, is a virtue. There's a hadith that describes content, qana'a, in a very beautiful way. It says, al-qana'atu kanzun la yufna. What does that mean? That qana'a, content, is a kenz, which means it's a treasure that never ceases to yield. It continuously yields. It continuously gives. And if you've noticed, if you've ever been content with what God has given you, you feel like even though the amount of what you have hasn't increased, but it happens in a way where that those blessings that are already there in their life, they are magnified in your eyes. They are magnified in your heart. And when they're magnified, you see them as more as than what they really are. So the attitude of Banu Israel was that the grass was always greener on the other side. There's always something out there that's better. And you know, as human beings, we tend to perceive things not as they are. We always tend to look over to the other side and think, well, if only I had it a little bit better. If only my salary was a little bit better. If only my, you know, if my family was structured in a different way. If I had siblings that would support me, or if I had parents that supported me. And we never really look to what we truly have. And so we don't find meaning in any of our struggles. We don't find meaning of any of the good things in our life. There's a story that I was reading. It's very interesting. And this is a story that's told by Viktor Frankl, who some of you have probably heard that name. Viktor Frankl was a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist. And why his teachings were so significant is because he was a Holocaust survivor. He was in a concentration camp, and when he came out and survived from that concentration camp, he wrote a book, Man's Search for Meaning. Some of you have probably read this book or heard of this book. It's really one of the most powerful books out there on how, according to his observations, some people were able to survive while others were not able to survive, given that they both had the same physical conditions, that they both lived in the same physical conditions. So they both groups or both parties of people had the same amount of food and access to medicine and clothing and same living conditions. And so after he gets out of the concentration camp and he goes back to work and he starts providing therapy for people, he develops the idea of logotherapy, which is therapy based on meaning, finding meaning in life. And so he talks about suffering, not to alleviate suffering, but he says that suffering, and this was his thesis, that suffering ceases to be suffering once it has meaning. Most of the time we suffer, and the suffering from our suffering comes from the fact that we don't know why this stuff is happening to us. Think about it. Because, you know, we know, intuitively, we know that everybody's going to suffer. If it comes to, you know, when it comes to financial struggles, when it comes to health struggles, when it comes to relationship struggles, we see people living around us. Nobody lives that perfect, pristine life where they're not struggling. Personally, why we struggle is because of the fact that we don't, there's no meaning in it. We don't understand why. And so he narrates this event. He says the following. He says, once an elderly general practitioner consulted me because of his severe depression. So someone comes up to him and he has severe depression. He says he could not overcome the loss of his wife who had died 2 years before and whom he had loved above all else. The loss of his wife had caused severe depression in him. He said, now how could I help him? What should I tell him? Normally when someone is grieving, in an attempt to help that person, what do we normally tell people when they're grieving? There's a few phrases. You know, we'll tell people, oh, don't worry, you'll get over it. Oh, you're very strong. That person is in a better place. You know, the cliche phrases that we use. And most of the time it's out of well intention because, you know, you love someone or you feel for someone, you don't want to see them hurt. So you project what you're thinking onto what they're thinking. You're stronger than this. You're going to get through this. Don't worry about it. He's in a better place. She's in a better place. And what we don't understand is that it really, if you've been on the other side of those comments, it never really helps. It may help for a minute or 2 minutes, but that doesn't do anything to help with understanding. And most of the time, people who are grieving, they simply want to be understood. They want to be heard. They want to know that someone understands what they're going through. And it's very, very profound what you begin to learn if you've ever studied counseling or anything like that. And you know, in chaplaincy, we're taught that your job is to lean into the pain. And if someone is grieving, instead of saying, "Well, don't worry, you're going to get over it," or whatever, say something like, "Well, this person probably meant a lot to you. It probably really hurts that person is not in your life." So you see the difference between just giving a person an admonishment or trying to heal them versus actually understanding or attempting to understand what that person is going through. So he says that I was going to ask this guy, I was going to give him admonishment, but instead I refrained from telling him anything, but instead confronted him with a question. He asked him a question. He said, "What would have happened, doctor, if you had died first and your wife would have had to survive you?" Think about that. Think about the situation from the other side of the fence. What happened if you were going to die first and she was going to have to survive you? "Oh," he said, "for her, this would have been terrible, how she would have suffered." Why did he come to that? Because he had suffered himself. And he loved her, and he knew that she loved him just as much as he loved her. Whereupon I replied, "You see, doctor, such a suffering has been spared her. And it was you who spared her the suffering, to be sure, at a price that now you have to survive and mourn her." That's the price that you have to pay. So he said, "No word, but shook my hand and calmly left my office." Because he had now thought of it from the other side of the fence. That either she passes away and I suffer, or I pass away and she suffers. And it seems like this man, because of how much he loved her, he would have rather chose him suffering versus her suffering. And it's not like this question removes the suffering. He says it does nothing to alleviate the suffering, but he says that it changes a person's perspective because now it has a meaning. Versus when we suffer normally in life, the question that most people ask is, why me? Why is this happening? But if you truly understand and come to terms with why this is happening, it takes on a different attitude. It takes on a different perspective. He says, I couldn't help him, but I did succeed in changing his attitude towards his unalterable fate, inasmuch as from the time on he could at least see a meaning in his suffering. At least he could see something. And so, you know, going back to that idea that the grass is greener on the other side, we really don't know what's on the other side. We tend to think that there's something better or something worse on the other side, but we really don't know what's going on the other side. So when it came to their faith and when it came to their attitude, the Banu Israel, for the most part, not all of them, always thought that there's something better on the other side. There's something that I'm missing out on. Now, it's interesting because the Quran tells us about Ashabu Sabt. Who were Ashabu Sabt? In chapter number 7, verse 163, he says the following. He says, وَاسْأَلْهُمْ عَنِ الْقَرْيَةَ الَّتِي كَانَتْ حَاضِرَةَ الْبَحْرِ. So, Ya Rasulullah, ask them about the people that were stationed or they lived by the ocean, by the sea. إِذْ يَعْدُونَ فِي السَّبْتِ. So, we're told that there was that the Sabt, in Arabic, the word Sabt refers to Saturday, the day of Saturday in the week, and that in the Jewish faith, that was a day of observation of the Sabbath, and that's where the word Sabt actually comes from, is from that word Sabbath. In Hebrew, it is Shabbat, which corresponds to the Arabic Sabt, Saturday, Sabbath. And that was a day of observation, a day that, according to some commentaries, that Moses, during the time of Moses, and this is what some Islamic commentaries say, that he had asked them, that which day do you choose? And again, this is Banu Israel having choice. So he tells them, which day do you choose for you to take as a day of rest? And they chose Saturday. And for the most part, the community of Banu Israel, they would abide by the rules until the time of the Prophet Dawood. And we notice that, you know, when God describes religious communities, and of course, you know, Banu Israel are the prime example of that, that over time, what happens? You know, as time goes by, they begin to let go of some of their obligations. They begin to, some of the teachings become deviated. They take on a different meaning. Some of the teachings become, you know, completely forged and they turn into something else. So the Quran tells us that during the time of Dawood, and this is what was happening, that during the Sabbath, and because they were this group of people, they were living in a port city, their livelihood depended on what? On fishing. And so they were in a little bit of a predicament, because narrations tell us that specifically on the day of Saturday, the Sabbath, the day that they were supposed to not work, all of the fish and all of the sea life or the marine life would come to the surface on that Saturday, on the day that they couldn't catch anything, on the day that they couldn't do anything. So it says, the Quran says, إِذْ يَعْدُونَ فِي السَّبْتِ إِذْ تَأْتِيهِمْ حِيْتَانُهُمْ يَوْمَ سَبْتِهِمْ. That their حِيْتَان, the fish and whatnot, they would come to them on the day of their Saturday. And it says, إِذْ تَأْتِيهِمْ حِيْتَانُهُمْ يَوْمَ سَبْتِهِمْ شُرَّعَ. It would just come to them in abundance. وَيَوْمَ لَا يَسْبِتُونَ لَا تَأْتِيهِمْ. So on every other day that was not Saturday, it would not come to them. So they were in this predicament, and they're thinking, how do we basically, what do we have to do to get to this other side? What do we have to do to be able to work on a Saturday? So what do we do? And so narrations tell us that they figured out a way to kind of, you know, cut corners and get rich quick, so to speak. So what they did was, they built canals and trenches. They dug canals and trenches so that the fish would naturally come towards those canals and trenches, and then on the day after, as soon as they're able to work, they would put up a dam so that it would block the fish from going back. And that caused sort of a divide between them, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells them that that they were not blessed, and their blessings did not come to them, because even though they had these 6 days that they can work, that they can go there, they can put their nets out or however they would fish and bring to them their sustenance, they saw that one day that was totally forbidden for them, they wanted to take advantage of it. And so sometimes we think to ourselves that there's all this opportunity around us, but we look for that path of least resistance. We look for that easy way of getting what we want out of life. And sometimes we don't realize that we're looking at the other side of the fence, thinking that the grass is greener on the other side, but you have everything that you could ever want in order for God to bless you in your life. There was a story I mentioned one time, I'm not sure if I had mentioned it in detail, but there was a book that was written called Acres of Diamonds. And the book was written by Russell Conwell, who was the founder of Temple University. Temple University is one of the oldest universities in the United States. And Russell Conwell was a very interesting figure because he was a farmer turned lawyer turned minister. And what he did before the age of the internet and before the age where you could just record something one time and everyone would see it on YouTube or whatever, he would actually go from one city to another across the United States and deliver this sermon. He delivered it more than 5,200 times. And the story, the central story, or the central thesis was Acres of Diamonds. And it's a fictional story, obviously, but he says, the way that he tells the story is that in somewhere in Africa, there was a man who had a large piece of land. And on that land, there was a creek with running water. And he was doing very well for himself. He would produce crops, and he would sell those crops, and he was doing really well until one day someone came up to him and talked to him about diamonds. He had never seen a diamond before, ever. So someone explained how shiny the diamond is, how beautiful it is, and how much monetary value it actually holds if you can get your hands on a few of these diamonds. So he says that this man sold what he had. He sold his land and everything on it, and he went around the world in search of looking for a diamond. And in the end, he never found any diamonds. And, you know, he died a terrible death. He drowned in the water because he was looking for diamonds or something like that. He says, on the other hand, the man that purchased the land from him was one day walking around the land, and he looked upon the creek where the water was, and he found a sparkle, a little blue and red sparkle. And he walked up to it, and he picked up this big, gorgeous diamond. Now, he didn't know what diamonds were, so he took it back home into his house, but it was beautiful, it was pretty, and he placed it up on a mantle. And then one day, he had someone come in, and he saw the size of this, 100-carat, 200-carat diamond that was just sitting up on the mantle, and he almost fainted. Because he's thinking, where did you get this from? He said, I'm just following the little twinkle, the little sparkle that was in the water in the creek that I own. And so he led him to it, and upon finding it, he realizes that his land is sitting on acres of diamonds. That there was so much value in that land that the previous owner had not even bothered to search, because he was thinking that his happiness and his success and his sustenance was going to be somewhere else. And so he went around the entire world and he didn't find that sustenance, and he died without it. Now, the moral it has nothing to do with the material aspect. The moral of the story, and it was very interesting, because as Russell Conwell was going from one state or one city to another city and delivering the sermon, every time he would reach a city or a state, he would read the news, he would read the stories, and he would find relevant examples in that same city where someone had given up their lucrative trade in order to go across the world or across the country in search of something that was more lucrative. And so he tells this story to tell people that, look, everything that you want is already there. You don't have to go halfway across the world. you know, during those times, and I believe this was probably in the 1800s or the late 1800s, where the California Gold Rush had already happened. And so people had moved from one part of the country, risking starvation, risking death, risking, I mean, during those days, they didn't have highways like they had today. They didn't have an infrastructure like they had today. If you traveled from one country to another country, or state to state or city to city, you risked dying. You risked people, you know, stealing from you. You risked coming face to face with thieves and highway robbers in order to gain a few flakes of gold. So everything that you want, the moral of his story is everything that you want is already there. Again, not that you don't become ambitious, but know that as a creature of God, as a creation of God, God has already instilled within you ingenuity. He's already instilled within you greatness. He's already instilled within you all the great qualities that you want and you need in order to achieve the things that you want in life. And so when you look at the downfall of Banu Israel from that perspective, that they could have made a great nation, and God says that in the beginning, that we had already made them a great nation, that we had created kings from them and prophets, but they were not able to see the greatness in themselves. They always thought it belonged somewhere else, with people that were worshiping a shiny object, or with people that they thought had better food or better sustenance than them. So knowing how to balance between being content and being ambitious, it's an art and it's not a science. So there's questions that we need to ask ourselves. What I have right now, am I taking advantage of? And one of the questions that allows us to understand our perspective is to think of our responsibilities, and I shared this with some of the youth a few days ago, that think of your responsibilities as less of a burden and more of a privilege. That not, I have to take care of my parents, or I have to take care of my children, or I have to take care of my spouse, but rather I get to do this. God has entrusted me. And the more that I accept the gifts that God has entrusted me with, the more that He will give me. There's a story that I heard recently. One of the contemporary scholars who wrote a number of books, and these books are nothing really miraculous. It's just a gathering of information and an analysis. He traveled to Najaf al-Ashraf, and he visited one of the grand ayatollahs, one of the maraja. And so when the marja received him, he asked him a question. He began to inquire. He said, What's so special about the books that you write? Where does this magic come from, the books that you write? He says, every time you come out with a book, I'm eager and I'm longing to read this book. He says, what's the secret? And so the scholar, he tells him the following. He says that, you know, I mean, is it a special library that you have access to information that nobody in the rest of the world has? He says, no, it's absolutely not that. He says that the reason I became so successful in terms of the books that I print and why they've gained worldwide popularity is because my father, towards the last few years of his life, was so ill that he could not take care of himself. He couldn't, you know, just basic functions he could not perform. He couldn't feed himself. He could not clothe himself. He couldn't bathe himself. And out of all of my siblings, he said, I was the one that volunteered to take care of my father for the last few years of his life. He said, I had to do everything for him. I had to leave, you know, different opportunities that came to me. I had to, you know, immeasurable amount of time that I had to invest in taking care of him. And he says, that's the secret. That's why I believe that God blessed me. It's not because I have access to a secret library or anything like that, but because I realize that God put an opportunity in my life, which many people would look at, and in many cultures and societies, what do they do with an ailing parent? It's very easy to put them in a nursing home. Sometimes you don't have to pay anything out of pocket, and you know it's very, very convenient because you go there and you know they have you go to a modern nursing home today and they have all the amenities and there's association and you know, they give them food and they get to play bingo and with other people. But he saw that as an opportunity as a blessing in his life that would move him forward in other areas of his life. So the question is, are we always looking at what we have as a burden, our responsibilities, or are we looking at them as a blessing in our life? That God is about to bless me if I take care of this amana, take care of this trust. And that's just a change in perspective. And that's a choice. It's a choice that we all have to make. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us with that wisdom. Just a few words to end. These days we are commemorating the martyrdom of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salawatullahi wa salamu alayha. And when you study the life of Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam, one of her most outstanding features was her compassion, the heart that she had. And the fact that she took compassion really to the next level. So much so that the Imams told us that the reason she was named Fatima, according to one hadith, I'll share this with you, says, إِنَّمَا سُمِّيَتْ فَاطِمَةً, the reason she was named Fatima, لِأَنَّ الْخَلْقِ فُطِمُوا عَنْ مَعْرِفَتِهَا. Which means that, you know, the word fatam means to wean, when a child is weaned off of its mother's breast milk, to cut off, to separate, to wean. The Imam says that the reason she was named Fatima is because al-khalq, which is humanity, has been weaned off or cut off from her ma'rifah, which means truly recognizing who she was and what she stood for. Really, almost an enigma. And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he obviously had a soft spot for her, not just because she was his daughter, but because of the compassion that she had and the way that she treated him. And one of the titles that he gave to her was Ummu Abiha, the mother of her father. Think about it, the Prophet, his mother passed away when he was very young. His father passed away before he was born, but his mother passed away when he was very young, only a few years old. And so almost as if the world, you know, robbed the Prophet of that motherly love, the tenderness that comes with that motherly instinct. And so every time Fatima would come in, he would refer to her as Ummu Abiha, that she is the mother of her father. Not only a great daughter, but also really a great mother. And he respected her so much, and he honored her. Narrations tell us that at a young age, she was very young, but she would enter the room, and the Prophet would actually get up from where he was sitting, and he would sit down on the floor in order for her to take his spot, so that he can shine the spotlight on her and show the world how honored she was in his life. I remember watching an analysis a number of years ago, and it's so interesting because it reveals to us truly how ignorant we are as a human race and humankind as to the status of who she was and how important she was in the life of the Prophet. And this guy was on TV in one of these very glorious, intelligent Arab countries. And he was trying to psychoanalyze why the Prophet married different women in his life. You know, first he married, according to him, an old lady, Khadija, and then he married a very young lady, Aisha. He said it's because the reason why he married an old lady is because he was missing a mom in his life. And so he needed a lady that was older than him. And then he said the reason why he married a young lady, a very, very young lady, according to them, 6 years old or whatever, is because he was missing a daughter in his life. So he needed someone to fulfill the role of the daughter. And I thought to myself, what a genius. Then what was Fatima if he didn't have a daughter? What was the role of Fatima? And Fatima was not only a mother to him, and not only a daughter to him, but she was also a mother. So if you pay attention to what the Prophet is saying, instead of your using your own bird brain, you realize that role of a daughter was fulfilled for the Prophet, and the role of a mother was also fulfilled. And nobody could have fulfilled that role for him. Nobody could have fulfilled the role of a compassionate daughter and a loving, tender mother. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us to be among those who receive her intercession. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. اللهم اغفر للمؤمنين والمؤمنات والمسلمين والمسلمات الأحياء منهم والأموات تابع بيننا وبينهم بالخيرات إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك قاضي الحاجات إنك على كل شيء قدير برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين.